If you want to enjoy financial freedom, then you have to understand how the stock market works, how to structure your portfolio, and how to handle different types of risks. This webinar is presented by Paul Sewell, who is an authorized financial advisor. If you want more information like this, then subscribe, hit the like button so you do not miss the next one. And now, enjoy the talk by Paul.
But it's well up in 2020, but this was contingency planning in 2019. ASOC, I'm putting you in charge of pandemic contingency planning. Calculate the impact on our business if 50% of our employees are unable to be productive. ASOC, that's twice as good as we're doing now. Just make some slides that say it would be bad. So how can we protect against stuff that might not even happen? Well, that requires diversification. So the formula for success is developing a strategy and having the discipline to carry out that strategy over time. So given that efficient diversification is necessary to maximize the risk-return trade-offs, so how do we go about that? Well, look, the first step is to consider your own personal risk tolerance, your objectives, your time frame, your age, and your income requirements. So I'll use myself as an example for that. So some of the objectives in the short, medium, long term that I have, I've got to finish off a kitchen renovation. In 2 years' time, I'll have to upgrade the family car. In 3 years' time, hopefully we work through COVID and I can take the family on an overseas holiday. In 5 years, I've got to paint the house. Then I've got a 9-year period of paying for children's tertiary education. And then I've got to look after my retirement planning. So we have to consider what our short, medium and long-term objectives are, understand our tolerance, our risk tolerance, and then we've got to develop an asset allocation that will meet those criteria. So that is, how much of your investment portfolio do you invest in cash, fixed interest, property and shares? And that becomes your strategy. So the next requirement is to have the discipline to stay with the strategy over time. More recently, Kiwis have shown that perhaps we aren't too good at staying with our strategy. When markets sold off in March this year, many Kiwis went online after markets had sold off and went into their KiwiSaver and changed their KiwiSaver from growth to cash or to conservative funds. And no doubt they've missed out on the swift bounce back in markets. So the discipline requires rebalancing of your portfolio back to the predetermined allocations that you set in the first place. And this discipline goes against our emotions. And consequently, it's very easy to stray from the strategy. So it's hard to sell down investments that are going well and invest into others that aren't doing as well. So KiwiSaver investors should have been doing the opposite to what they did in late March and April. Now, over the years of investing, I've asked many clients, and in fact, investors, what they want. And this is a standard risk return trade-off chart. So follow my cursor here. So risk along this axis, we all sort of fit somewhere between here and here, and we will all have different risk profiles. That's unique to ourselves. And then on the vertical axis, we've got returns. So low returns through to high returns. And guess what? When we ask the question, what do you want? We all want low risk and high returns. That makes sense. But not only that, we probably don't want to pay any tax and we want low fees. So the problem is that the asset classes we have to invest in don't actually fit into our client comfort zone, do they? So cash, low risk, low return, fixed interest, slightly more risk, slightly higher return, property, bit more risk, higher return, New Zealand shares and international shares. So the more risk we take on, the higher the expected return we're expecting from those asset classes. So if we want higher returns, you have to take on more risk. So what does that actually look like. So this chart here, it's from Morningstar Research. They're a global research company that offices around the world. They do research on economies, on direct investments, bonds, managed funds, exchange-traded funds, and they've put together a chart over a 37-year time frame. And so over here, if you can follow my cursor, we've got 0% return here, and then we've got positive returns going up the side, and then we've got negative returns down here. So we just focus on this risk profile here. So this is a medium risk investor or a balanced risk investor. And typically, if you're a balanced risk investor and you're following your asset allocation, you'll have 50% of your funds in shares and property, and that will be onshore in New Zealand and offshore, and you'll have 50% of your funds in cash and fixed interest or bonds, and it'll be onshore and offshore. And that is your asset allocation, say, for a balanced risk profile. So in any one year, statistically, we know that your worst case scenario is minus 15%. So if you follow an asset allocation with a balanced risk profile, the worst case scenario is minus 15%. So if you're investing $100,000, I can tell you quite comfortably, in the next 12 months, if you pop in to see me, that $100,000 might be worth $85,000 today. On the upside, it could be plus 50. So it could be up to 150,000. So we've got no idea what returns are going to be over the next sort of 12 months for a diversified portfolio. And it'll range between minus 15 to plus 15. So you get a return somewhere between there. So you've got to be comfortable with the worst case scenario. And that helps to determine what type of asset allocation you will follow. Now, the thing about investing is, and we talk about the medium and the long term, if you're following an asset allocation strategy, and this chart here is showing you that after 3 years of following that discipline strategy, there's not a chance of having a loss of your capital. So the worst case scenario is about 0%, best case up to 27. So you'll get a range of returns between 0 and 27. And then after being invested for 10 years, you can see that there's no risk of loss on your investment. And in these numbers, it's saying statistically on average was 10.5%. Just disregard those numbers because they're not numbers that we're going to be able to get, we don't believe, over the next 10 years as historical data. But the key point is here is you need to understand your worst case scenario for your investments or any individual investments that you make. And if you're quite comfortable with that volatility, then you can perhaps take more risk and you hold more of your investments in shares and properties. So I sit over in this category where I have 100% of my investments in shares and property, but my worst case scenario in any one year is there could be a drop in value of about 46%. So you've got to work out what your risk tolerances are before you develop an investment strategy or look at what you're investing in.
Sorry to interrupt. If you enjoy this content, make sure you subscribe so you do not miss the next one. And hit this like button to let me know that you want more information like this. Thank you.
So typically when we think of risk, we think of, we're making an investment, are we going to get our money back? But there's two types of risk, market risk and unique risk. So market risk is the possibility of an investor experiencing losses or a drop in valuation due to factors that affect the overall performance of financial markets. So on that chart, we've got interest rates. So interest rates going up or down, inflation, is it high or low, or deflation? Are there economic risks? Well, COVID-19 has certainly been an economic risk that is influencing the financial markets as a whole. Exchange rate risk, geopolitical risk, monetary conditions, fiscal policy. Perhaps to give you an example of, say, inflation risk. I knew a gentleman, he retired in 1970, and he retired with $100,000, which was a lot of money back in 1970. He was conservative. He wanted to live off New Zealand super, and he wanted to some income to come from that investment. And his end goal, though, was he wanted to leave the $100,000 to his estate to be passed out to his five children. Now, being an ex-banker, he was very conservative. He invested that $100,000 into New Zealand government stock. So back in 1970, you could receive a 6% return from New Zealand government stock. So he was happy. He was getting a $6,000 a year on top of his New Zealand super. It was meeting his cash flow requirements. And he passed away in the mid-80s. And he achieved his objective of leaving the $100,000 for his estate. But the problem was that you have to cast your minds back to the 70s. You might recall that inflation took off in the 70s and the 80s. And in 1970, that $100,000 could have bought 33 new Holden Commodores. They were selling for $2,933 in 1970. When he passed away, unfortunately, his estate could only buy 3 1/3 Holden Commodores. They were selling for $29,300 in 1986. So although he'd achieved his objective, the problem was that inflation ate away the purchasing power of that money. So we need to ensure that we are getting a return above inflation to keep the purchasing power of our money. And in fact, inflation is what governments are wanting to do. Currently, we've got a whole lot of monetary policy and fiscal spending going on. We're doing a whole lot of borrowing. And when you think about it, governments need to have low interest rates and they want slightly higher inflation. Because if they can borrow, so 10-year government stock, New Zealand government can borrow at 0.7% for 10 years now, and inflation is at 2%, over a 50-year time frame, you can see how inflation can eat away at that debt. And so that's what Western economies are hoping for over a long period of time. So if they can keep interest rates low, inflation is a little higher, it'll eat away at the debt. So that's just, an example of some market risks. Then we have unique risks. So unique risks can be losses or a drop in value associated with a specific investment or a particular investment. So let's say you take your $100,000 and you can invest that into a corporate bond. So you lend a corporate $100,000, they borrow that off you and they pay you an interest rate for that. Now, if that company goes bankrupt, they're obviously going to default on that $100,000 and you're not going to receive that back. So that's a unique market risk. Then you might have management risk. When you're making investments, it's obviously wise to look at the management team, their depth, their experience. Have they added shareholder value in the past or have they detracted from it? So you need to look seriously at the management teams to try and avoid unique sort of risk in investing. Also financial risk. Are companies, is there a lot of debt? Things highly leveraged. If you're highly leveraged, what happens if interest rates go up? There's business risk, there's industry risk. You're investing in an industry that is out of favour. Liquidity, can you actually sell your investment? What happens in tough times? Is there a market for that investment? So these are unique risks. And so the question is can all these risks be avoided? Well, no, but they can be considerably reduced through diversification. So the four, and you've got to diversify across the four asset classes there. And obviously the returns are ranked in the same order. And so it's diversification across asset classes and the geographical boundaries that helps to reduce those risks. So risk is certain with any investment. It's unavoidable. Return is not so certain, but if you manage the risk, the returns will result. So I want to take a look at now at these different asset classes and how we can access them. And so it's a busy slide coming up, and I'll spend a fair bit of time discussing this. So this is from ANZ New Zealand Investment Limited put this chart out. And it's just saying, it's a history that shows that investment markets rise over time. So how will I explain this? So it's the value of 10,000 invested from 31st December 1989 through to the 31st December 2019. And so if we start over here at $10,000, and if we follow this dark blue line here, that is investing in the New Zealand share market, and it's the all NZX All Share Index. So we've got $10,000. You may recall back in 1990, we had a recession in New Zealand. So if you invested back then, within a sort of 12-month period, investment markets have come off, so your investment's worth $7,000. And then you can just see the up and down movements of the New Zealand marketplace. And there's always events and shocks going on that affect volatility in markets. And this one here, up here, is the global financial crisis. We had quite a large downturn at that point in time, but you can see that markets continue to rise over time. And that investment now, if you just invested broadly in the market, would be worth $155,000 today. Then this line here is global bonds. And if we follow that line, we can see a lot less volatility, investing in government stock around the globe, and $10,000 invested from 1990 would now be worth $115,000. So that's been a remarkable return from fixed interest or government bonds globally. And it's also been the case for New Zealand shares. But we've been living in an environment where the last 30 years, all we've known is interest rates were very high. And we've been in an environment where interest rates have just continued to fall. And that's created a great environment for being a bond investor. But the problem is, the next decade, that can't be repeated, we don't believe. Because if you're investing in 10-year US Treasury or government stock in the United States, you're going to get 0.5% return on a 10-year Treasury. So this line here is inflation. And if inflation runs between targets 1% to 3%, let's say it runs at 2%, and if you're getting 0.5% from US Treasuries, you're going to be, that chart is, line is going to be down here. You're not likely to get a return above the cost of inflation. So inflation will eat away at the purchasing power of your money. And the orange line here is the Australian share market. It'll now be worth $110,000. This line, brown line here, is government stock in New Zealand. That's worth $83,000. This is international markets. $10,000 now, we're $73,000. And this line here is QV New Zealand house prices. So $10,000 invested in New Zealand housing. You can see not as much volatility and valuations, and that would now be worth $58,000. And you invested in New Zealand cash, your $10,000 would be $55,000. So look, we're pretty lucky today as we literally have thousands of options to choose from. We can invest directly into investments. We can invest into individual shares, into bonds, to property. We can invest onshore and offshore. We can invest in managed funds, exchange traded funds, listed investment vehicles. And these can be listed on stock exchanges and they can also be unlisted. So generally, Kiwis access managed funds from the New Zealand marketplace or the Australian marketplace, or they tend to buy shares, exchange-traded funds, or listed investment vehicles on the New Zealand, the Australian, New York, and the London Stock Exchange. So when you're using managed funds, listed or unlisted, typically there's two types you can have. You can have passive funds or active funds. So the chart that we've been looking at is really using passive funds. So passive funds For example, you can hold a passive fund in the New Zealand market. You can hold the top 50 companies in New Zealand, so if you invest $10,000, that can be split between the top 50 companies, and that's split in order of the market capital weighting of each of those stocks. So it's a quantitative modelling, so there's no skill set behind that. And as a result of that, you should be paying lower fees to access passive funds because of that. It's not always the case though. Then you can have active management. And active management is all about professional fund managers believing that they can add value above the market by not holding the whole market, but selecting stocks. So they would say, why would you hold the good, the bad, and the ugly? Let's just try and hold the good stocks. And they feel that they can provide a better return for the risk-return trade-off through active management. Perhaps just as an example of active management, I used to work for a funds management company in Sydney. They managed $26 billion on behalf of mum and dad institutional investors in the Australian marketplace. Now, they had a team of 40 investment professionals. A number of them were portfolio managers, and they had research analysts. And their job all day, every day, was to look at markets, to do the research, to meet with companies, to meet with management, and to select a portfolio of stocks ranging from about 15 stocks through to 80, to give you the diversification, depending on what their mandate was. And if you're using an active manager and you've got a team of people, clearly active management will charge generally charge a lot more than, say, passive management. So the fees that are charged can range from 0.08 for a passive fund listed on the New York Stock Exchange through to about 1.5% in terms of management fees. So you can have funds that invest in just New Zealand shares or Australian shares, global, or you can have country specific. You can hold small cap stocks, large cap, mid cap. You can also specialize in technology stocks and blockchain and artificial intelligence, robotics, pharmaceutical companies, you name it. Generally, it's available. So we've got thousands of options. So what to invest in? So it's impossible to predict the best performing asset class from year to year. And this is from Morningstar Research again. And if we look over here, we'll just focus on the top part of this chart. So it's a periodic table of market performance. And this is the best performing asset class down to the worst performing asset class year on year. So in 2010, global property returned 20.6%. That's New Zealand dollars hedged. And then 2011, the best performing asset class was New Zealand bonds, coming in at 12.4%. Then 2012, you have New Zealand equities returning 25.9%. 2013, it was global equities and New Zealand dollars hedged back to New Zealand dollars, producing 31%. Then global property at 29%, New Zealand equities at 15%. Global equities, 10. Then emerging markets came in at 34%. Emerging markets investing in countries like China, India, Brazil. New Zealand equities, 2018, came out top of the pops with a 6% return. And then in 2019, New Zealand equities produced 31%. And year to date, the best performing asset class has been New Zealand bonds. So you can see from this matrix that it's impossible to pick best performing asset classes. And that's another rational reason why you have diversification across the board when you're developing a strategy and a portfolio. So I wanted to take a look at valuations. And typically, the less we pay for an investment, the better the likely long-term return we will receive. I want to take a look at the fundamental value of companies or a company. So let's think about ABC. It earns $1 per share. The market pays $16 for each share then it's willing to pay $16 for each dollar of earnings. So we call this the price earnings ratio, or the PE ratio. So to increase the share price, we have to increase earnings, or the amount that the market is prepared to pay for a dollar of earnings. So we'll take a look at that in practice. So we can think of returns coming from three places. Firstly, dividends or income, and secondly, capital growth. And capital growth results from an increase in earnings or increase in profitability. So those are the two fundamental drivers of returns when we're looking at investment. So income, dividends, and capital growth resulting from rising earnings. Then capital growth or loss that comes from rising or falling sentiment. That is how much the market's prepared to pay for a dollar of current earnings. So the change in the PE ratio can reflect market sentiment. So the example I'm using here, so a company with a dollar's earnings, it has a price earnings ratio of 16 times, so that trades at $16. So in other words, the market's prepared to pay $16 for each dollar of profit. And so in this example, the company, it's earned a dollar, it decides it's going to pass on 64 cents to you as a dividend or as a shareholder. So you receive 64 cents, so that works out to a 4% dividend yield. And over the course of the year, we want the profitability to rise, don't we? So the profit of this company rose by 5%. So the earnings per share was $1.05 earned. So we actually earned $1.05. The market PE stays the same at 16. Therefore, the capital value is $16.80. But if the market got more confident that the price would go up some more, and in this case, it's another 7%. So that returns for this investment would be 6% over that year. And in fact, so earnings $1.05, a PE of 17, so 17.19, so another 7% return, so total return of 16%. So, and in fact, look, I was working in Sydney, Australia, so this is an example of in Australia. That's exactly what the market did as a whole over 2007. So the market as a whole had an increase in earnings of 5%, and the sentiment changed by 7%, so the PE ratio increased across the board, and we received a 16% return. Now, on the other hand, if earnings fall, and the market turns negative about future profit prospects, then returns can be sharply negative. And this example here is just showing you that earnings drop 5%. So your earnings is 95 cents. The PE stayed the same. The share price would drop to $15.20. Now, the problem is that earnings sentiment, we've got a drop in earnings. The market sentiment became nervous and no longer wanted to pay 16 times for 95 cents in earnings. It was only prepared to pay 10 times for 95 cents of earnings, so the capital value dropped to $9.50. So that's a 42% drop in valuation of this company just because of a change in sentiment. And that's pretty well much what happened to the Australian share market in 2008 when the global financial crisis hit. So a small fall in earnings and a massive loss of confidence can impact on valuations. So if we can predict earnings growth and how much the market will pay for a dollar of earnings in the future, then we can forecast returns. And this helps us explain, what's happened in the past, but more importantly, lets us think about what might happen in the future. So if we can estimate how fast earnings might grow in the future and how sentiment might change, then we can estimate perhaps future returns. And as it turns out, obviously in the short term, it's impossible to forecast, but in the longer term, the longer the period we can forecast out, the better the forecasts become. And there's some forecasts here from a research company we use in Australia, from Farrelly's research. And they've done some 10-year forecasting as at June 2020. And so they're forecasting for Australian equities. They're predicting that the dividend yield that we'll receive from Australian companies over the next decade on a per annum basis is 5.8%. So that's the income or the dividend, that's the profit being paid back to you and I as shareholders in Australian companies. The earnings growth, so we're expecting earnings to grow over the next decade at 1.7%. And the market sentiment is going to be slightly positive for Australian shares. So the central forecast is a return of 8.4% per annum and with a price earnings ratio of close to 16 times here. When we go through developed markets, dividend yield of 2.6%, earnings growth of 2%, sentiment at 1.5%, forecast return of 6.1% per annum, and a price earnings ratio of 17 times. Emerging markets, 2.9% earnings growth, so expecting higher earnings growth from emerging markets at 3.2%, sentiment 0.5%, so positive sentiment. So central forecast at 6.6% per annum with a P/E ratio of 14 times. Listed property coming in at dividend yield expected of 5.4%, earnings growth of 1.8%, sentiments positive, and a return of 9% per annum over that 10-year period, and a higher P/E ratio at 16.7 times. So when we look at fixed interest investing, forecasting return over the next decade of 1.6%. So you can see that the amount we're willing to pay for a dollar of earnings and fixed interest is very high with a P/E ratio of 61.5. Then we get to residential property. We're expecting dividend yields from income at 2.5%. We expect rental incomes to grow by 2.9% per annum. We think the sentiment for residential property is slightly negative, and that's just around the sort of valuations that we're at within the marketplace today, and expecting a 4% return on a per annum basis. And you can see that the price earnings ratio expectation at 40 times. So we're prepared to pay 40 times for a dollar's earnings. So when you're looking at asset classes and looking at valuations, you can see that potentially there's some relative better value in other areas of the market, but we need to hold diversified portfolios. And just to throw up some other forecasts, and this is from ANZ Wealth Capital Market Assumptions. This was done in May 2020. And so what they're showing is that over the last 20 years, if you invested in the New Zealand share market, you would have received a 10% return per annum over that 20-year time frame. And the 10-year forecast out ahead is about 5.8% from New Zealand shares. Investing in global shares, slightly higher, coming through at 6%. Property, slightly higher. And then we can see the forecast from New Zealand fixed interest, global fixed interest and cash. So you can see that if we're wanting to develop a portfolio, our returns are not necessarily going to come from our defensive assets, but we need to have some defensive assets in our portfolio. It's all about the mix and how we invest across those different asset classes, depending on the risk that we're willing to take as investors. So where to from here? Look, first, personal financial planning, it's too complex and it covers too many fields for any one person to have all the solutions. So it needs input from others. And so I'd say seek professional advice from a properly qualified advisor and check out the advisors from Financial Advice New Zealand. And here's my disclaimer.
Fantastic, Paul. Thank you so much for that. I don't think we'll read that out loud. Might take a little while. If you just like to unshare your screen, and I've got some questions I think we could kick off with.
Right, have I unshared?
Not yet.
No. Okay, stop sharing.
Perfect, that's perfect. Thanks, Paul. What a great presentation that was. I certainly took some notes on that and learned a couple of things, which was good. So here is a quick question for you. I've approximately, and this isn't personalised advice, so please don't take this as personal advice if you're out there listening to it. Paul will give general advice back to you. I've approximately 450,000 equity in my home to invest. Is property investment my only option for investment? Do I need savings to use other types of investments? That's a really good question about how you view that diversification and what options are and what the thinking is around people thinking they have to have the savings to be able to actually invest. What's your views on that?
So in terms of the question is, do I use equity in my home to invest? Is that effectively the question?
Well, I think there's two things there. It's like, I've got equity in my home, so I can use that for property.
Yep.
How do I need savings for other types of investments? So if you obviously were going to borrow for other types of investments compared to borrow for property.
Mm. Yeah, look, it's we're fascinated, I guess, in New Zealand with property, and property has worked well because we can leverage, we can borrow someone else's money and buy an asset. So it's quite hard to do that when you're investing in shares, isn't it? Because the banks don't typically allow that. But effectively, if you could, and so I guess some people do, it's where you're going to get the better returns from. So that doesn't actually answer the question, because you probably generally can't borrow to invest in shares. But if I was trying to maximise returns, that's what I personally would be. But look, it comes down to individual risk profiles and what you're trying to achieve. So there is no right or wrong answer here. It's about developing what your own risk profile is and what your strategy is going to be. And yes, you can use your equity in your home to borrow funds to invest in an investment property. But then you've got to understand, what are the risks that I'm taking on by doing this? And there are several risks, and you've just got to be over what those risks are and make sure that you're comfortable with those risks no matter what you're doing. When you're investing, we're all investing in KiwiSaver, so you're saving money on a regular basis. So all of these principles we've talked about today are relevant in terms of investing.
Great, here's another question for you. Could you please address other asset classes, namely alternative growth assets like land-based investments?
Land-based investments.
Yeah. So what does that mean to you?
You want a land, your land banking?
Yes. In my world, when I think of land-based investments, I don't know. Would I think of a section, or is that too like literal?
Yeah. Well,
talking about an orchard. I mean, what do you view that as?
Well, so again, so my presentation today has all been about diversification, hasn't it? So we follow the principles of diversification. So if you're investing in just one particular investment with one asset, then we would just say you need to understand the risks of that investment. And you're taking on more risk because you're not diversifying across a broad range of investments, that's all. So hopefully what's come through today, when we're talking about risks, anything we do in investing, there are risks behind it. And we just need to understand what perhaps the worst case scenario is. And if we're comfortable with that, then there's no problem with the investment, is there? And so we've literally got thousands of options. So there's lots of ways to skin a cat, and there's no right or wrong way, but it's actually finding what works for you as an individual. And we are all quite different and unique in that process.
That's
so
right.
For me, look, I have property. I do have an investment property. I have direct shares. I have managed funds. I have exchange traded funds. I have money in New Zealand. I have money offshore. I'm very well diversified. So I'm covering my risk bases. So I'm spread across. I'm trying to maximize my returns, but I want to limit the risk of the loss of my capital. And I do that through diversification. And you don't have to have a lot of money to get diversification in today's environment. When you're using managed funds or exchange traded funds, effectively what you're doing is you're pooling your money with a whole range of other investors. And so you've got economies of scale. And then typically, you're either passive or active, you're using active, you're employing professional fund managers to manage that money on your behalf and to provide a diversified portfolio. So there's lots of easy ways to get diversification and cover your bases in investing today.
That's exactly right. And it's not necessarily having a racehorse, a wine, a bit of art, right? That's okay, here's another.
Nothing wrong with having that if that takes your fancy.
Diversifying across those three things. Okay, so here's another question for you. Are there any free tools to help with portfolio construction and asset valuation? I realise that there are many ways to value an asset, and depending on the industry, these valuations will differ. So then there's a second part to that one question. But if I am a retail investor using Sharesies or Hatch, what tools are available to me to help me value companies and construct my optimal portfolio? So there's about three types of questions in that question, yeah. Isn't there?
Yeah, look, I think probably the first calling point is the sorted site, isn't it? There's lots of tools and information available through Sorted. If you, in fact, well, I think we've probably got links to some of those tools on our landing page for the presentations this week, Katrina, is that right?
Not quite sure if we've got those types of tools, portfolio construction tools.
First starting point would be look at the Sorted site. There are a range of tools there. But look, in terms of if you want anything free, why is it free?
Was that question to me? So
it's difficult to what I'm trying to say is that look, if you're looking for tools that are free, perhaps the appropriate tools to be utilising. I'm not aware of, I can't pinpoint or direct you to tools that you can use for valuing companies. But we subscribe to many research houses to provide those tools available to us to be able to do that. And that's how we go about it.
And it's complex, right? You know, the methodology that these houses use is very complex. And it's for a sophisticated investor, isn't it, really? As opposed to someone who's just tinkering around the sides. There's a lot of elements to understanding a company's valuation.
Yes, that's right. It can be very complex, or you can look at it, take things very, very, very simply. But I think throughout my presentation, there's lots of elements involved in investing. And it's always worth getting second opinions from experts out in the marketplace, just to make sure you're on the right track in what you're doing.
Okay, here's a quick question for you. This one's easy. What does listed property mean, and what is the difference between developed and emerging?
Right. So listed property, if in the New Zealand marketplace, on the New Zealand Stock Exchange, you can invest into listed property companies. So you might have heard of, say, Kiwi Income Property Fund or Goodman Fielder Property Fund. These listed investment trusts, they invest in commercial property, industrial, and retail property around New Zealand. So investing in physical properties, and as investors, we can access that through those types of investments on the New Zealand Stock Exchange. And the other question was developed and emerging markets. So developed markets is Western economies that are developed. So the American marketplace, Europe, UK, New Zealand, Australia, those are developed markets. And emerging markets are the likes of, say, China, India, Brazil, and so on.
Okay, here's a quick one, because we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Could you briefly describe holding foreign currency as an investment strategy?
Yeah, well, geez, there seems to be lots of tools for trading currency on the marketplace. Currency is a very difficult thing to look at in terms of an investment asset class. When we look at currency in terms of investing, we're using it as what we call a hedge. So it's an insurance mechanism to reduce volatility. So if we're investing in government bonds offshore and we don't want to take the currency risk, then we'll do that by hedging the New Zealand dollar. So if you're getting 0.7% return for a 10-year government stock in the United States, you don't want the currency movement to impact on that return. So if the dollar goes up or the dollar goes down, you know exactly what you're receiving in terms of that investment portfolio. So currency trading, some people do that. That's certainly not in our warehouse. We like to use currency for hedging and reducing volatility within portfolios.
So there's a question here on cryptocurrencies. What's your opinion on cryptocurrencies? Is that with the racehorse or?
So the first thing I guess I'd say is what worries me is the absence of any recognition of Bitcoin as legal tender by governments. So it's not legal tender. So that would worry me. I guess what do we mean by legal tender? It's quite an interesting one, isn't it? Because we have the fair New Zealand dollar, it's legal tender, it's backed by the government, working under the fiat system. There's nothing actually behind that, but it's the confidence. We have confidence in the government that a dollar is worth a dollar. Back in the old days, the Bretton Woods system, you used to have to hold gold as a backing for that currency. That's no longer the case now. So a dollar, to me, that's digital currency. Our money in the bank, it's not paper money, it's digital, but it's backed by the government. Bitcoin is not backed by anyone. So that is a risk that you've got to be aware of. The other thing is that it can be susceptible to manipulation through actors and botnets. And your Bitcoin spot exchanges. So spot exchanges, unfortunately, there's a risk of fraud and manipulation, and that has been the case. So you can see I'm quite conservative. I've stayed away from that part on investing. But again, it's like anything you do, you've just got to understand the risks. And if you're comfortable with that, then that's fine. But I do recall we had a lot of interest in Bitcoin when it was around $20,000. Mm-hmm. So if you bought at $20,000, you'd be feeling a little upset at this point in time. But I'm sure there have been some people that have made money on Bitcoin.
Okay, so here's another question. For someone starting out in investment, how would you recommend they start? Active fund, passive fund, index fund? Is low fees more important than returns?
So again, I'm sort of taking, you sort of go back to working out what are your objectives, what's your strategy, and what risks you're wanting to take and what you're comfortable in doing. So you've really got to understand that before you make investment decisions, because that helps you to make the investment decisions. I have my own biases. I don't want to share those with you. Any of those options that you're talking about is a great starting point. When you're looking at fees, yes, fees are important, but you need to understand what you're getting for those fees. in terms of, say, active versus passive. So passive funds should be very cheap because it's just a quantitative modelling. There's no skill behind that. You're just holding the market, and anyone can do that. But with active management, what active managers are saying, well, why should we hold the good, the bad, and the ugly? Let's just try and hold the good stocks within the portfolio, and perhaps we can produce a better risk-adjusted return. And so typically, you've got to pay more for that. But you need to understand that if you are getting an active fund, that they are an active manager. So you've got to understand how they operate and how they go about it.